This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored in part by TradeStation. Find out more about how to get 90 days of free trading and more in this episode. Coming up.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A low-volume recovery. Drugs and prostitution is going to be added to the Italian GDP. Money's flown into international funds and stocks to watch. Lots more on episode number 365 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. Memorial Day is here. It is a wonderful time of year around the country. Weather is wonderful. We wish all the best to all of the folks that help out and protect our country and their families and extended families, friends, etc. And want to say a big thank you to anyone in the military, anybody that is protecting us from all the things around the world that may go awry. And there's plenty of that, not just in the financial arena, as we know, but also due to political instability, uncertainty. And we have a lot of that. We did see that this week there was a conference with Russia's Putin talking about how, sure, we'll be happy to do what we can to go along with the elections that are happening in the Ukraine. Who knows what that's going to happen and what's going to mean, because the elections seem to be just an absolute mess. There are protests, people not allowing others to vote, money changing hands for votes in one direction or the other. And it's just a ridiculous situation that's going on. So we're not quite sure what the comments by Putin really mean, are we? No, can't. Still, investors don't seem too worried. The S&P 500 hit a all-time high on Friday on some low volume. We'll get to that. We had a listener question that came in about what's the story with the low volume, what does it mean, and can you give me a little bit more details about that that I wanted to talk about. And also talk about some of the interesting things that are happening around the markets, around the world. This is Andrew Horowitz. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week to talk about money items, issues pertaining to the financial markets, and hopefully give you some ideas on how to profit in and out of the current investment environment that we have today and into the future. Of course, it is a process. As you know from my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, there is a process that is the way to go about things that doesn't always work, of course, because you know what? There are different conditions in the market. And one of the things that you have to remember is that you have to adapt and adjust on a regular basis. You know, we don't have a market today that maybe we had 2 years ago, 5 years ago. We don't have the same exact economic information that provides us with insight, because maybe we have, for example, today, the Fed that is taking on a massive process and strategy in order to hold up markets to increase the wealth effect. We have a certain condition in the real estate market. We have additional liquidity that maybe wasn't there before. And how do you adapt and adjust to that? That's some of the things that you have to do on a regular basis. The truth of the matter is that at the core of it, though, when you're analyzing investments, and particularly individual equities, the process is somewhat regular. I don't care whether or not we have a Fed in or out of the market. I don't care whether economics or this or that. Analyzing individual equities is all about quanta, funda, techna. Quantitative analysis and looking at finding those stocks through a screening process that you can find the best stocks that meet certain criteria whether it's growth or value, whether it deals with balance sheet items or cash flow items, whatever it is, or a combination of the both. Then you take it and you slim down your process by getting that list and then going through them individually, looking at the fundamentals and the underlying issues that pertain to each and every stock. I'm going to talk about IBM as a great example of that again today, a front page Bloomberg Businessweek story that came out just this week that I think really splashes a tremendous amount of light on really what's happening with financial engineering of the numbers, particularly with IBM and to a degree other stocks as well. And then you go through the final strategy and final process, which is technically looking at from all aspects where the price action is and if it is in fact a time to invest. So you go through screening down, slimming down the potential candidates, creating a watch list. Then you go into looking under the hood at each and every position and how the health of the company is on a financial basis, and then the timing. And when you look at the timing, you look at things like charts. And by the way, as you know, that this episode is sponsored by TradeStation, and charting is what it's all about when it comes to TradeStation. A lot more involved, but they do have a screening process. They do have fundamentals. And technically, there's none better when you look at what the program and the structure of TradeStation can do for you in terms of charting. And on top of it, they're giving it all away for nothing right now for 90 days. You get the actual platform for 90 days free, and you can get free trading for 90 days. So if you just want to check it out, if nothing else, if you're curious, say, hey, well, you know, Andrew's been talking about this. You know, we use it here, by the way. We use it to a pretty full extent of its capabilities, and it's very, very powerful. Very powerful. Well, you could do so. Go over to TradeStation.com or find the information on this podcast, this episode's show notes. You can find a link right there on how to get your 90 days free over at TradeStation. Now, I'll mention to you also that when it comes to the whole idea of looking at stocks and looking at fundamentals, there are times when fundamentals matter more than others. A good example of this would probably be Amazon. Take the last several quarters of earnings reports where Amazon came out and they were showing that they had an increase of revenue. Their margin overall was doing a bit better, although they still showed a loss. And in fact, they projected a continual loss moving forward because they were reinvesting back into the company. Now, if you were just to look at the fundamentals by themselves, going back, let's say, 2 years, you would say, ooh, wow, this company is way overpriced. The stock is reacting in a way that doesn't make a lot of sense when it comes to the fundamentals. They're spending an inordinate amount of money. Their earnings and the net earnings, their earnings per share, are really nothing. They're in the negative area for the most part. How do I really analyze this? Well, that's when you need to step over into the whole area of technical analysis, right? You want to look at the trend. You want to look what's happening with the stock. It would be very difficult as a value player, someone who really is only and specifically looking at fundamentals, to come to any conclusion at all about Amazon. But yet, the stock was progressing higher for some time. And all of a sudden, investors had enough. They said, you know what? You're not making money. You're projecting a potential $500 million loss the next quarter. And you know what? While I understand that you are building the infrastructure and putting a lot of money into the additional warehouses for delivery around the country and, you know, around the world, if depending on where they are putting their new facilities, and that would one day really enhance the distribution and one day will enhance the earnings and profitability of the company, and one day and one day and one day, and when is that day going to ever come? And all of a sudden, last quarter's numbers came out and investors turned, took the stock down about 30% from where it was. Now, what's the difference between this quarter or last quarter, the quarter before that, or maybe a year before that? Sentiment changed. Investors got tired of the promises. They're looking at, okay, you built out plenty. When are we going to start seeing the money? You know, Jerry Maguire, show me the money. Where is the net returns here? And how can I, as an investor at this point right now, how can I go about rationalizing the excess price that you have on the stock compared to where the earnings are, because I should see some kind of return from all the extra money that you put into the build out and expansion of your business. And it's really kind of an interesting phenomenon that you look at this quarter again and compare it to others. Now, this quarter, they did have a very significant loss that they were projecting coming into the next quarter, into the future, more so than they had in the past. But yet, investors still tried to pick the stock up, thinking that, hey, Amazon is just going to be one of these companies that disappoints on investments, guides lower and guides soft, but then comes back and eventually, someday, maybe, hopefully, will actually turn a significant profit. And when that didn't happen this quarter, I think investors got very tired of it. Now, I talked about IBM. There was an unbelievable article, just a hatchet job on IBM in this week's Bloomberg Business Week. It was the front page, talks about questions about how is IBM making money. Now, you remember for some time we've been talking about how IBM has been doing what they can to boost their earnings per share by sale buybacks, by selling off parts of the company. This particular quarter, they had all sorts of non-GAAP numbers that were all over, probably about 200 different references to non-GAAP accounting methodologies that they used to come up with the numbers, putting up a signal that, hey, wait a minute, now not only are you doing things like taking back, you know, 20% of all your shares and buying them back over the years. And while you do have this profitability number and this EPS number that you project out that you're saying that you are committing to over the next 5 years, and now it's about 3 years from now, the fact is that you're disappointing us and people are standing up and noticing. IBM is a shell of a company of what it used to be, but yet the stock maintained a significant value. You had Buffett coming in and buying it. Buffett doesn't buy technology stocks, but they buy IBM. You got dividends, so therefore you have people that are looking for yield buying the stock. You have an increasing EPS if you just looked only at EPS. You see that it's increasing on a regular basis, but yet revenues were slowing down. Sales were suffering. Many of the parts of the company were really seeing major downturns. Their hardware business is a problem. Their cloud business, which they said was going to be the next area that they're going to see extensive move to the upside and margin expansion. Well, what happened? Well, you had competition from Google and Amazon and Rackspace and all these companies that are coming out and slashing prices and cutting into the profitability, because IBM needs to stay profitable and they need to stay competitive. So now what happens with IBM is now you're starting to see investors turn. And right now, it's a very interesting point for IBM, because I really do wonder what the future holds for the company if, in fact, all they are doing is engineering higher EPS through accounting methodologies. And one quarter, two quarters, investors will say, okay, that's fine. But you know what? We're starting to get a point that IBM is starting to look very questionable as a long-term play, aside from their dividend, aside from the fact they have cash. But you know what? Until they do something that's very different and groundbreaking, return to their competitive edge, there are a lot of other companies right now that really are going to overtake them, and IBM is just going to suffer. I talked about this a lot over the last 6 months. I created the question, what is this company on the DH Unplugged show? What is IBM? I don't even know what they are anymore. They're not what they were. And from right now, I don't see that they have any kind of innovation that's going to substantially change things. Yes, they could buy some companies and all that, but the company itself, the core of IBM, is withering away. It's being competitively eaten up by the others out there that are doing what they can to hop on board the latest change in the newest technology, and IBM is slow to catch up. We saw that HP, for example, last week, although stock was up 7% on this news after it initially dipped, laying off another 16, 17,000 people. Why? Well, they are really hurting for business. And as we always talk about, cutting expenses is good. Human capital is very expensive, right? You know, you have salaries and benefits and all sorts of things that go along with employees. Healthcare is very expensive. What is going to happen with HP moving forward? Well, There was a collective sigh of appreciation about cutting expenses and therefore doing what they can to increase the overall net profitability of the company. But at the same time, you have to wonder, wow, what is happening with this entire business? How much does it need to consolidate? Anyway, think about that. I also wanted to touch on this whole idea of this low volume recovery. Yes, the S&P did hit 1900 for the first time, closed above it on Friday on extremely soft volume. In fact, I just looked, the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE volume count was the lowest of the year on Friday. Now, that's to be expected when you have a holiday, an elongated holiday weekend. So that's fine. I get that. But we've seen a progressively lower amount of volume hitting the market over the last few weeks on the upturn, on the recoveries. And when there is a sell-off, when there is selling that goes on, you're seeing a significant amount of volume increase. This is something that has been part of this market condition for the last year and a half or 2 years. But that can't maintain forever. What I mean by that is this. Volume can be equated to commitment. The commitment of individuals to actually buy something or sell something. When you have a withering volume on a regular basis across either a stock or a sector or even an index, as we have seen, there's a lack of commitment. Now, stocks can still move higher because maybe people aren't inclined to sell at a certain price, so therefore the sell price or the offer price may move up, and buyers that are out there that are looking to buy, even though it is not on high commitment, will pay a higher price. And essentially what we're saying is there's PE expansion going on in the marketplace. So you're looking at the future and saying, oh, I'll buy that, and even if it's $10 today and maybe $10.50 tomorrow and $11, I'm still going to buy it because I think there's a great opportunity here, but yet on a low volume basis. Now, what happens is that if and when there is the selling that goes on and the selling comes in and there hadn't been a lot of buyers out there really committing to things, well, you really see stocks get hit pretty hard and the volume comes in because there is a lot of holders of the equity right now or the index, let's say, and they go about selling. It is not a good sign. Let's make this very, very clear. I don't care where we are. I don't care where we are in terms of the pricing, if we're at a record or not. It is not a healthy market condition to have up days on very light volume and down days or distributions happening on very significant volume. It shows us that there really is simply the idea that the sellers are waiting for the stocks to come up and then whacking them and let them recover a little bit and then whack them. In other words, let's look at this differently. Let's look at a single stock scenario. You're a seller. Stock's at $10. When you start selling, you drive that stock down to, let's say, $9.50, a 5% move down. Well, you know what? You don't want to flood the market with the shares that you hold because you really could take this down very significantly. So you got to sell out slowly. That's why you see the selling that goes on that takes the stock down and then they kind of roll back into a higher volume situation and then it stops. And then because of the fact that we've had this inclination to buy the dip over time, buyers will just come back and buy it at any price and bid back the stocks. And the sellers come back in another day and they bid it down again because they want to sell. And this process repeats itself. Until there's a break, something happens one way or the other. Either the sellers say, okay, I'm done selling my positions. They've bled it out over time. They've done it smart over a period of time. Or they say, you know what? I really want to get out of this point, and I see a lot of negativity happening for whatever reason, whether it's the economy, whether it's a political situation, whether it's the an individual stock situation, and they start selling, and therefore it's met and really drives down stocks. That's what happened in the last couple of months with the social media, technology, the biotechs, and a variety of other stocks. There's a rotation and a sell. There really wasn't a lot of buyers pushing back with volume that could really absorb all of the amount of selling that was going on. Now, at the same time, the other side also, you could have a break. The sellers go, okay, the selling is exhausted, and all of a sudden buyers step back in, and they do it on volume. Now, that would be a very good sign if we start to see a very good volume uptrend going on over a few days without a significant higher amount of volume on the down. So you have a successive series of days that see exceptionally good volume, maybe 10, 15, 20% higher on either a stock or an index or a sector, an ETF. You see a higher amount of volume being bought, meaning there's a commitment to that position, not just a trading position. A commitment to that. They're willing to put their money in there, realizing the fact that it's relatively thin trading historically, but yet they are putting their line in the sand saying, hey, you know what? We're willing to put this in now and buy it in a big way without seeing higher volume on a following day or following period on the downside. So while we get used to certain things, and we are used to the fact that there has been this drop in volume, it's not a good sign. Let's just get that straight and get that out there. It is not a good sign to see increasing volume on down days and decreasing volume on the up days. So I hope that answers the question. But this low volume recovery that we're seeing is also something that's part and parcel of what we've been doing. You know, so there is some liquidity out there. There is the idea that the Fed will just be there at all times. And this goes right to play with what Gaither has been talking about. As the great moderation is returning again with its complacency in the markets, the VIX hit about 11.5 on Friday. 11.5! Think about that. Normalized, quote-unquote normalized VIX is somewhere around 15 that I usually would call it. Anything under that is starting to see a bit of complacency, lack of the fear that's going on. And again, you have a lot of things that could be showing up as concern. You have China slowing down. You have Japan, a question of whether or not Abenomics is even working at this point. You have Europe, where you have things like Italy. I want you to listen to this. Italy announced that they're going to include illegal drug and prostitution revenue into their GDP to boost their GDP numbers. There are so many questions with that. First of all, it's pretty absurd that this could actually go on and it would be allowed. Second of all, how do they know the numbers? The whole point is it's an underground black market situation. How do they even know what the drug revenues are and the prostitution numbers if it's illegal and it's not regulated? Where do they come up with this? Essentially, what they're saying is, hey, we're going to throw some kind of numbers into GDP to make it look better, and we'll say it's from prostitution and we'll say it's from drug, but we really don't know these numbers. We're just going to throw something in there to make GDP look better. And that's going to be allowed and that's going to be tolerated. Now, if investors, in fact, allow that to happen, and in fact, there is some kind of regulatory environment that allows that to happen, I don't even know what to say about that. It's scary, to say the least. I can't even bring to mind what words can really accurately describe the disgust I have for that occurring. They have to go to those kind of means to boost their GDP. Imagine if we did something like that here. I mean, think about the different things that you could actually put into that. The crap that you could actually just say, okay, hey, now we're including this inside of that. I mean, just bring some kind of BS numbers into the economy and to try to say that is something that's going to boost GDP, that's going to throw off all the GDP of the past. Well, it's being done. So now we have a scenario where we have markets that are showing signs of acceptance of central banks just being there, complacency with some of these kind of things that go on, complacency with the fact that, oh, markets will never go down again because we have all of this excess amount of promises from the global synchronization of central banks. And while we can see things go on for a long time in this nature, it doesn't bode well for the future of what is going to be the result, because once we start seeing this kind of nonsense go on, much like what we saw in 2006, 2007 with the complacency on homes and the ability for people to pull money out of their homes and refinance and housing price would go up, and nobody thought at that time we're ever going to see any problems because, wow, real estate only goes up. The fact of the matter is most places around the country in the U.S. right now are still not recovered from the highs they hit. And those highs were some ridiculous numbers, of course. Now, will we see another real estate crash? Well, probably not to the extent that we saw it before, because there is a difference now in that banks are a bit healthier and they're not lending like they did. But yet we still have a tremendous amount of houses that are still underwater when it comes to their mortgages and recoveries that never occurred at all or anything to speak of in many cities around the country. Sure, there's those outliers. You got California, New York, Florida, Texas, North Dakota. You know, some of those markets have done very well, but there are very specific reasons why that is. So now we have low volume, we have shenanigans, right? And we have promises. Now we have one of the big things that is the biggest promise that is coming aboard right now is the Draghi drop. Mario Draghi over in the European region, he is the central banker there that has promised that he is going to do something in June, right around the corner. A lot of money has been pumped into the euro area. As a matter of fact, we'll take a look in a moment about the ETF flows into the and out of the fixed income and equity markets in the U.S. and internationally. A lot of money has been pumped in because he says, you know, he is going to do some kind of, well, whether it's going to be quantitative easing or something to reduce the value of the euro, which is hurting the region. We saw last week that the German confidence index really was soft. They have a real negative outlook right now in terms of what's going on in that area, as well as the fact of their hurting due to the Russian-Ukraine situation and all that's going on there. And we add that all up, what we have is the hope, the prayer that Draghi can actually do what he can to reduce down the overall value of the euro and to boost up the quality and stability of the bonds, the banks, and their economies. Now, funny or horrifying or ridiculous is that bonds in some of the countries that were the worst hit, let's call it Spain and Portugal and Italy, those bonds are yielding some of the lowest values. In other words, investors have pumped tremendous amount of money into them on the promise that the central bank will back them implicitly. They're so low, it's ridiculous. You should see a chart on this. The Italians are the lowest they've been in decades. There's so much money going into that area. And while we're on the subject, have you thought about why it is that the 10-year is about 2.50, 2.5% again on the U.S. 10-year bond? We have this really weird scenario going on right now. We have stocks that are actually moving higher and bonds that are being bought at the same time. That usually doesn't happen. Usually when investors are looking for safety, they buy bonds and they sell stocks. But no, what's happening is they're buying bonds and they're buying stocks. Gold's holding up, hasn't dropped really significantly past the recent drop we saw, been holding. Silver, commodity prices are moving higher. Where's all the money coming from? Well, maybe it's draining out of China. Maybe it's draining out of Japan. Maybe it's draining out of much of the Asian countries. We have a lot of money going in, once again, into promises, into India. Stock market up 30% this year so far in India. Pretty impressive. On just the election. Nothing's been done. It's on the promise of hope or the hope of promise that there's something going to be changed dramatically there. So a lot of the market right now is hype. Now, that doesn't mean that it is not real, but it's a lot of hype. It's hype that we're going to have central banks doing what they do. We're going to have governments like in India doing what they do to help to keep things up as best as possible. It's coordinated, or at least it's synchronous, either one. But at the end of the day, you really have to wake up and say, wait a minute, there's a lot of complacency in this market. We've talked about that. And I talked about how there's going to be some major drops happening. We saw a couple over the last couple of weeks. And I do not doubt, as I am sitting here, that we are going to see another couple of sell-offs moving into the summer as volumes dip even lower due to the fact that oftentimes summer is a time when volumes drop. And as such, without that commitment that we've talked about, those down days are going to start getting rougher and rougher. And if, in fact, a few of them line up back to back, and if there's a disappointment in maybe some of the central bankers' moves or in governmental moves, or if there is another flare-up in Russia, take your pick of what it is, that VIX is going to fly. I am absolutely beside myself that the VIX is at 11.5. Talk about severe levels of complacency. Quite unbelievable. And you add that to the fact that the world will tolerate the drugs and prostitution revenues being added back to GDP for Italy. You really have to scratch your head and say, what the hell is going on here? Something is just not quite right. And when we consider all the things that are going on around the world with the elections in Europe that have recently occurred, and some of the parties that are winning are very much all about, of course, bearing the brunt of the financial situation on the government rather than the banks. And you see that you're having the Italian banks, and as I mentioned, the bonds moved down, but the banks moving back up with the idea that there'll be an implicit guarantee behind the banking and the financial institutions, financial industry. You got to just still kind of wonder, okay, how long can this really go on? Now, I want to skip over for a second to India. In India, what we saw, that there was an amazing amount of appreciation for the fact that there was a new government that was potentially going to come in. This is prior to the election now that happened was decided last week. Now, when we see that there is this incredible amount of, I guess you would call it, hope and wonder and real excitement about what the future prospects would hold for the country. And you see a 30% gain in the core index over the last few months, and I think 19% this month itself. You have to sit back for a second and wonder if there is more to come, or is it oversaturated? Is it overbought at this point? Is it a point that there is too much enthusiasm going on? Now, you did see that the Indian market after the election did continue to surge a bit, and you saw that there was a lot of money that came in, a lot of good commentary by many different analysts about how this is really, really good for the economy. They're still fighting an inflation problem. They're still seeing a lot of money come in. The rupee did, in fact, move up higher, and then it seemed there was intervention already to bring down the value of the rupee to help out the exporters, and some of the banks did, in fact, sell the rupee by dollars. And this is maybe a point that we want to consider. Just possibly, just a thought, looking at some of the stocks or maybe even the index, one of the ETFs, to kind of take a short-term, short swing positioning. And if you did see that the buy the news, and or if you want to call it, kind of buy the news and then sell the reality is coming into play here, that may be something that you want to think about. I would just think that this is an interesting time to look at that. Look for if there is any weakness and if there's some profit taking that goes on, and maybe make a few points for yourself on the short side for India. Now, I also, if you recall, we had talked about the amount of money that was, in fact, rolling into and rolling out of different markets. And I mentioned that we would talk about how that's playing out if, in fact, we see something interesting. Now, I did some numbers and some calculations on the weekly net flows, the dollar flows into and out of the pool of ETFs. We can benchmark how much money is coming in or out of markets that way. So we look at domestic equities and international equities, ex-US. We can look at domestic fixed income and international fixed income. Now, here's what is shaping up as very interesting. So going back to the beginning of this year and looking at how things are going, you would probably think that there was a bit of a takedown and sellout and removal of money, withdrawals, if you will, from domestic equities in January and February. And you'd be right. Absolutely no question about that. Big, massive amount of withdrawals, $20 billion in 1 week, as a matter of fact, in the beginning of February, after we started to see that the equity markets were rolling down in January on the domestic side. And then you look at what happened after that. Now, what happened was we saw that there was all of a sudden a massive amount of money pouring into equities. As a matter of fact, the whole month of February into March, to about the second week into March, there was a good amount of money, on average about $5 billion per week, being poured into domestic equity ETFs. So we took all the ETFs that were domestic equity focused and looked just at those and calculated the amount of money net that was being put in or taken out. The largest amount of flows into the equities was in the week of April 11th, with about $6.5 billion. And the biggest outflow was in March that we saw, February and March of both times, about $8 billion. Now, what's been happening recently? You would think with the S&P marching on to a new high, you would see that domestic equities in general would start seeing a lot of inflows. That would make a lot of sense. Why not, right? You see that as things are getting better, people are putting more money in, more commitment, as we mentioned earlier. And there you would see that there would be more money flowing into domestic equity ETFs. Now, what's really fascinating is since April, there's only been 1 week of inflows. Only 1 week of inflows of money into domestic equity ETFs. And there hasn't been a tremendous amount of outflows. Let's start talking about the end of March. We saw that big outflow, about $8.5 billion. Then you saw a couple of just very minor kind of moves in and out. And then we saw progressively more money coming out till we saw in the beginning of May, about $5 billion in 1 week came out, turned around the next week. And then again, last week, another about $4.5 billion, even with the S&P hitting a new all-time high, money was coming out. Now, where was it going? Here's what's fascinating. First of all, the interesting point and the head-scratcher clearly is, wait, we're seeing that there is an all-time high being made, and this dovetails into the discussion we had about volume, that there's no volume. And if there's no volume, there's no commitment. And we can see that there's no volume and no commitment in the fact that there is very little flows into domestic equity ETFs and funds. It went into international. Since, I'll call it, about the end of February, there has been a tremendous amount of monies moving into international, which is Europe and the Japan area, China, you know, everything international, not U.S., tremendous amount of money is moving in there. The flows have been positive every single week since about, we'll call it, the beginning to mid part of March. There hasn't been 1 week of withdrawals or net withdrawals. Of course, there are people withdrawing, but I'm talking about the net. There's been none. We're seeing some big numbers in there. As a matter of fact, in April, there was some really big numbers, $4 billion in 1 week, and then just progressively a billion into international funds. They're also moving money into domestic fixed income. As you would find that when stocks come down, when people are looking for safety, you would see that domestic equities would be moving lower, and you would see that domestic fixed income would be moving higher. In other words, you would see that U.S.-based investors that are looking for U.S.-based exposure would be possibly, if there is a concern, moving out of equities into bonds. That's exactly what's happened. You see that there is a big inflow. As a matter of fact, last week, it was about $5.5 billion of inflows into domestic bond ETFs, fixed income, all sorts, whether it's junk bonds, whether it's corporates of some sort, whether it's the treasuries. They're moving in money as opposed to withdrawing. So the net inflows in domestic fixed income is pretty high. Again, quite counterintuitive to what you would think would happen as we're hitting new highs with the S&P. International fixed income has been a bit of a mixed bag, although the last 4 or 5 weeks has been positive, with the idea that Mario Draghi is going to be doing something in June. I think that a lot of investors are trying to get ahead of the curve and put money to play there. That's why we're seeing that the euro has been moving up as well. Same thing happened as we talked about with India. As there was more money coming into that market, we see that the rupee has been moving higher, and that is problematic for their exports, but it's just the nature of the business. When you have a lot of money coming into a country and have a lot of money coming into the financial system, and the various indices, whether it's bonds or it's equities, you're going to see that there's going to be a move on the currency. That just makes all sorts of sense. The one thing that is just perplexing is why we haven't seen the commitment to domestic equities. Is it the fact that there's a big concern about the earnings outlook? Is it the fact that very, very simply, that the Fed, while being very accommodative in their interest rate policy, they are talking about an increase or at least slowing down or stopping, essentially, additional stimulus in the form of bond buying by the end of this year and potentially in 2015 in the beginning or sooner, looking to maybe do the first increase of interest rates. So maybe there's people that are getting ahead of the curve there, where you're seeing that other countries around the world are looking to do things that are much more constructive into the future. Now, let's look out. You know, they say that the stock market is one of the best discounting mechanisms out there, right? So you're looking at what's happening in the future and about 3-6 months into the future, and what happens now is probably what's happening then. So are we seeing the first signs of a significant amount of net withdrawals from domestic equity funds and a rotation into other areas around the world that may be a bit better in terms of their overall valuation, that are not picked over as well as the stocks here in the U.S. are, that have better growth prospects, that have not seen the massive buying that we saw in 2013, profit-taking going on? That's what this shows. So again, just to summarize this whole idea of the net inflows of money into ETFs on a weekly basis, we're seeing that there is a net outflow, generally speaking, over the last month and change, 2 months, from domestic equities, inflows into international equities, inflows into domestic fixed income, and international, I'll give it a mixed bag, really not much going on there. But still, the writing is on the wall in terms of how investors are playing it right now and where they're positioning their assets in terms of moving into the broad-based sectors on a global basis. Now for a holiday shortened week, happy Memorial Day again. We're going to cut this short this week as we have lots of things to bring up next week. We're going to talk about this Bloomberg poll that came out with some advisors and an interesting survey that was done next week. Also, make sure to listen to DH Unplugged, which we'll have out early this week. And if you have any questions, want to talk to me about anything, send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.